what I hope to do,
at any rate, is get through the discussion of a can. And that's only because I've got so much material on conscience that even though I've given us 6 hours to talk about it, for me to have a manic monologue about it, whatever, I'm sure you're going to need at least that much time. And we need some Kant as background, so we can get through that. Okay, let's... We left off last time with the skeptical collapse about culture, with my suggestion, at any rate, that we might well want to, as it were, think about the possibility that that conception of culture is not very far from our own cultural situation, which is to say that perhaps, I want to echo perhaps, we have nothing like the French Revolution, nor Napoleon. I hate to think of the thought of Ronald Reagan, the Napoleon president, codifying the best moral insights of the time, as something that is a cultural magnet. And that is a kind of presumption of this whole text, that the French Revolution was a highly charged but ambiguous achievement. Right? And the way to examine that is to look at Kant's comments on the French Revolution, where he doesn't know what to do with the ambiguity between the problem of the terror on the one hand and the moral impulse on the other. And what he does do, rather remarkably, is, and in this bizarrely Arendt follows him, is to separate out action and judgment. And he says, from the point of view of action, obviously putting the king's head on the guillotine would be morally wrong, but from the point of view of the spectator, we cannot help but feel enthusiasm. But enthusiasm should never be the perspective of the actor. So we're committed to, on the Kantian account of politics, we cannot inhabit. And that is, in a way, Kant's whole problem with respect to the relationship between action and history, I want to say. There's a book by a man named Booth. I can't remember anything else. If you want to read a book on that deals with this, seems to me very intelligently. I think it's published by Toronto. There can't be many books on Kant's philosophy of history by a man named Booth. Okay, let's go back though to faith and pure insight. Skepticism about culture, about its vanity and hollowness, bred, unsurprisingly, or was responded to, along with, I should say, other phenomena, including the rise of the new science, a new type of religiosity as an expression of the desire for spiritual substance. Essentially, we have a series of movements, Pietism in Germany, Jansenism and Quietism in France, Wesleyanism in Britain, in our own day, you might say Kierkegaardianism, that in it opt for an emotional relationship to essence, to God, the absolute, that no rational discourse could ever get on level terms with. And the great text of this is Pascal's Pensée. This is not a trivial position. Indeed, I think the Pensée is much more subtle in its detecting of the aporetic character of reason than Kierkegaard's Critique of Dialectic. So I would, if you don't know the Pensée and think, you know, Kierkegaard is the right kind of existentialist, I would suggest really reading Pensée. They're really quite remarkable. Now, this notion of faith, just the leap of faith in Kierkegaard, which is only a leap, of course, from the perspective of a later moment which had already felt itself to be constituted by an impossible rationalism. But you should know that even in Hegel's time, that thought was present in the writings of Lessing. Something called Lessing's Ditch, which has to be leapt over. Corresponding to this is the passionate naturalism that we call the Enlightenment. And it's very important to understand that the Enlightenment began in its French form, not its German realization in Kant, but in its French form in, amongst the philosophes, as a kind of naturalism, which nonetheless had a commitment to unbiased thought and observation. Hegel will call pure insight. Now, as we're going to see, and this is something that should unnerve us in certain respects, the fundamental Enlightenment gesture is ideology critique. The Enlightenment and ideology critique, as Sloterdijk in his Critique of Cynical Reason, a book which, no matter how one wants to respond to as a whole, is quite right to recognize and chart. In a way, Marx says, you know, the critique of ideology begins with the critique of religion. Okay. And the critique of religion really begins with the Enlightenment. And it's important that we see the continuities between the early critique of religion and what we have come to think of as ideology critique, unmasking, disenchantment of the world. One is tempted to say, indeed, from a Hegelian perspective, or Hegel wants to say, I think, that in that critique, insofar as it's located with relationship to this model, and that would include in Marx, never escapes from what we're going to see as the problematics of the presumption of ideology critique. Now, despite this, what would appear to be absolutely opposed position, a faithful gluing of oneself onto the absolute through an act of radical faith on the one hand, and on the other hand, a position dedicated to neutrality, observation, and critique on the other, faith and pure insight share two fundamental assumptions. Firstly, they both believe that in order to know anything is to submit it to authoritative grounds that are not dependent on any transcendent source for its authentication. Say that again. To know anything is to submit it to authoritative grounds not dependent on any transcendent source for its authentication. That's why the leap of faith is a leap, after all. That it's the accessibility of the absolute is dependent on my faithful turning. Hence the wager, right? The point is that the validity of faith isn't itself dependent on God. Rather, it's the act of faith which is meant imminently to reveal the absolute, which is why faith has to precede, and the leap has to precede, right, the relationship to the object. Secondly, they both think that to know anything is to be in possession of grounds for belief that hold universally for all individuals. Now, this universality is not charted in Hegel explicitly, and we should just think of it as a significantly overdetermined phenomenon. It obviously derives in part from what we've already seen in terms of Roman property law. As bizarre as that might sound, there is a universalizing gesture there, because the notion of legal personality means anyone, right? And that meant that there's no such thing as the intrinsically slavish as opposed to the intrinsically... The second one is simply to know anything is to be in possession of grounds of belief that hold universally for all individuals. Simply now the thought that knowledge is both imminently grounded and universalistic in its claims. And I was asking after the sources for universalism, because Hegel doesn't explicate them in any kind of detail. The second limb would be, of course, that it is implicit in all three of the great monotheistic religions, universalism. It is simply part of their ideology that they have universalism. Thirdly, and equally importantly, it is implied by the reductionism of the new science. Indeed, there are ways in which I think you can actually get to a lot of meanings of universalism just by trying to understand what was required in order to make sense of the arrival of the new science. Now, as forms of spirit, faith and pure insight give on to, and this is Hegel's uneasy claim, the whole of spirit, but in diremptive form. Roughly, the notion of faith provides a conception of substance or content, although it does so in terms of a conception of essence as beyond intellection, while pure insight is a form of intellection which requires whatever appears to to meet the standards of a wholly negatively defined conception of rationality. Hence the mind here, the rationalist sensibility of the Enlightenment, expresses negativity and process. It's as if everyone in the Enlightenment rationalist side were from the state of Missouri, right? Show me. The most unintellectual state in the Union. Oh, that's hard. There's a very bright priest in St. Louis. Now, we then have, and are setting up, and we should be aware that Hegel is setting up, a relationship of pure insight and pure faith, and it's the purity that's the problem here, which, in fact, is a macroscopic cultural version of Kant's first critique. That is, what we have is pure insights, that is, pure concepts, which we know that are without intuitions, are empty, and we have pure essence, or intuitions, which without concepts are blind. Hence, there is, or we should conceive of, and there's a tension in it. But I like to think of the relationship between pure insight and faith as an early and, for me at least, this may be something of my autobiography, that is, a misspent youth reading philosophical texts, but for me at least, the first clear approximation of the fundamental structure of Hegel's notion of both speculation and of speculative unity. That is, what's driving this whole section forward is the thesis that pure insight and faith are one. Or, to use the language I used last night, Evan, that faith and pure insight are two halves of an integral freedom that do not add up. That's a phrase from Benjamin, by the way. Walter Benjamin. In the letter to Adorno, where he's talking about high art and popular art as two halves of integral freedom that do not add up, which may show a different Benjamin than the one you're used to. Now, the notion of faith then refers to Hegelian substance, the being of the world, while the notion of pure insight is a figure of Hegelian subjectivity. And what we have here then is an anticipation of the speculative sentence that is driving the entire phenomenology forward, namely, subject and substance are one. And I say that this particular formulation here is helpful because it presents the issues in a way that are free from the more standard epistemological formulations about thought and being. That is, the subject-substance relationship is a variation on the thought and being one. But, of course, the Hegelian notion of substance is that of spirit. spirit is subject and substance. But they are appearing here. Remember, we're reading the history of spirit, and we're reading the history of spirit's coming to self-knowledge. There, spirit is appearing here in a diremptive form. Now, as Hegel makes clear, pure insight has, and its problem is that it has no content of its own. Pure insight is rather a drive to intellection and rationality, a metaphysical desire, we might say, for universality. And as such, it poses a challenge to every content to meet its standard of rationality. Paragraph 537, right at the end, of course. This pure insight is thus the spirit that calls to every consciousness, be for yourselves what you all are in yourselves, reasonable. To use the vocabulary of Kant's, what is enlightenment? Enlightenment is when we no longer let priests and monarchs do our thinking for us, but come to think for ourselves. So the be rational, right, is the attempt to appropriate imminently contents that have been expressed as externality. Now, enlightenment gets, and this is culturally significant, the enlightenment as project should not be conflated, as a cultural project, should not be conflated with the new science, which of course is a content. The enlightenment as a cultural project requires that what we're looking for is making the lessons about rationality that the new science, in a sense, offers into a kind of cultural reality. Hence, for those of you who have done actually historical study in Enlightenment will know, it's why, along with the encyclopedia and stuff like that, Encyclopedia Britannica view of the dispensation of knowledge, democratization of knowledge, a lot of the practice of the Enlightenment had to do with certain kind of educational reforms and projects. Now, what makes this believable? What makes this project one that can have cultural impact? How does Enlightenment reveal itself as not just, so to speak, presenting rational criteria for knowing, but a spiritual vocation, after all. Something by means of which people can claim identity for themselves and give meaning to their lives, which is part of what is meant in the idea of the philosophy. Well, what Hegel says in paragraph 541 is that pure insight gives itself content through a skeptical procedure. And of course, in order to operate a skeptical procedure, you'd better have something to be skeptical about. And the thing that was most obviously there, ready to be skeptical about, was religion, since religious belief in most perspicuous ways clashed already with the claims of the new science. And despite, we may say, the attempts, the first attempts of reconciling gestures that we find in Pascal, and that's part of the tension. So the movement of the Enlightenment is a movement of negativity, of what Deleuze and Guattari call in their book Capitalism and Schizophrenia, Anti-Capitalism? Anti-Oedipus. Capitalism, Schizophrenia, right? It's the notion of decoding. And the difference between their analysis and Hegel's is only that they perceive the reaching of the degree zero of decoding as a revelation of a materialist base, right? That is a kind of truth. While Hegel's going to say, you know, if you decode, then you're left with just what you'd expect. Nothing. Right? I mean, that is, can you have a degree zero of allegory? There's a piece by Jameson where, for once, he actually gets it right. And has an interesting critique of Guattari on just that question of whether the notion of degree zero of allegory, the idea of absolute decoding, is not itself another figure. Which then gets translated in what they do, of course, is make that into the figure of figurality itself, which they then say is the limit, and so on. And you get the typical movement of a continual passing of a limit, which is a passing of a relationship between an illusory sense and its materialist, nonsensical basis.
Is that a prisoner's of language?
Hmm?
Is that Jameson?
No, it's much later. It's in one of the essay collections, yeah, I think. And I'm not sure that it's an essay. It may even be in the Weber piece, because that's a piece on Muslim history. I'm not sure which, but look in the index of his books. You're suffering all these. That's what it is for me to talk without my library. That's why I actually do a lot of my teaching in my house. So I kind of run around all the time, give people books, read that, make cups of coffee, and just keep talking. Okay. Faith then is cited by Enlightenment as a realm of error. Namely, the idea of the masses as naive and credulous, who therefore are suffering from the lack of the drive for enlightenment by being faithful. The thought that this disposition of the masses is itself a product of a totalitarian regime, which we call the priesthood, that is, they are victims of priestcraft, which itself, of course, is a form of despotism. This is all paragraph 542. Now, because emotivist faith is itself fundamentally a skeptical faith, it has no resources to withstand pure insight. Hence, one of Hegel's deepest concerns is to show how part of the victory of the Enlightenment occurs because the use of reason in its now, what I'm claiming is merely skeptical formulation, spreads into faith itself.
Into
the practices of faith, and also into the self-consciousness of the believers. So faith, which is important for the analysis here, because spirit is a domain of certainty, right? And he's asking how passionate faith becomes uncertain about itself, becomes anxious faith, so that even the standpoint of faith, which is supposed to be the emotive affirmation and leap and, you know, all that stuff, actually lacks the resources precisely because of its own skeptical positioning to sustain its own form of certainty.
By emotivist, what have you brought in? Is that a new definition that he's using of faith?
I mean, No. I remember I said I talked about the Wesleyans and so on. Okay. These are all, you know, the reasons, you know, reasons that, you know, the heart knows reasons that the head knows not.
Right?
That's Pascal. So there's an assumption here of a problematic of reason that has become disconnected from affection, has become non-affective in its fundamental structure, which is really important. This is Kant's great flaw. It is, in fact, the flaw of modern rationality. The idea that you can have a conception of cognition which lacks any affective moment. We may say the disaggregation of cognition and eros. Okay. So it is not surprising that in response to a modern rationalism, which is, we might say, value neutral, which is to say, I would want to say, therefore located nowhere in affective space, then the response to this is a passionate religious sentimentalism. Where I mean by sentimentalism, the reflective relationship to the sentiments. That's what sentimentalism is always in its technical sense. So we criticize it, I mean, in the sense that when we say someone's sentimental, we mean they're not in love, they're in love with the idea of love, right? That's a sentimentalist. That it's a doubling of the problem of affect. And I'm suggesting that in structural terms, there's a relationship between what I'm calling these emotionalist religions and the continuation of those things, say, the 18th century sentimentalism. It just ain't surprising. You look really puzzled.
Oh, no,
by
no,
it.
No, it's really interesting.
So,
mm-hmm.
That is set to do with the playback scene.
Yeah.
So
I never know what I'm saying. I love to hear it.
So the problem is that this kind of faith is inherently skeptically structured.
Yeah.
Because it isn't grounded in an actual immediacy.
It's grounded only in immediacy.
But it's a constructed immediacy, right?
Of course.
And that's the problem.
Which
can't be. It's not actually just being one with the substance.
Of course.
It's a constructed kind of being one with the substance. And so, but what happens in this revelation of the skeptical character of it is something else. It's because this immediacy that has a kind of self-reflection is the structure that it shares with enlightenment, with pure insight. But the interaction between them is what undermines the ability of that skeptical position to uphold itself. That's a kind of move from skepticism to unhappy consciousness again. Same kind of problem.
Absolutely. But one that, which of course we can hear already in Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have to go very far, because the unhappy consciousness, you know, the thinking reads stuff, you know, here I am, this lonely little, yeah, you know, this great vast thing, yeah, help! You know, that's what the wager is,
mm-hmm.
a cry of help.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The important point here is that it's that unhappy consciousness has no powers of resistance, hence the victor is the pure insight. That's the figure that follows. say more about it. The point is, yes, it does produce the unhappy consciousness, which is hence the game that all Hegelians play with the relationship to all Kierkegaardians. Kierkegaard says Hegel's wrong, and Hegel says, no, you're an unhappy consciousness. But the point is, that move, you know, Kierkegaard is simply about 150 years too late. I mean, the Kierkegaardian moment was the early 17th century. And the victor here, of which we're hearing the last gasp of in Kierkegaard's discourse, is not the unhappy consciousness. That Kierkegaard's just the continuation of the victim here, loser of that battle. The victor is going to be pure insight, which will turn into something else, or its skepticism will take on new forms. Let's see how it does. Yeah, well, let's do it pretty quickly. I mean, the point here is that and Hegel's analysis is long and complicated for the following reason. Pure insight in attacking faith is attacking itself. Right? That's why he sets up this structural identity of pure insight and faith. Hence, the movement of the critique of faith. For example, the attack on God, yields an attack on all content, so that, for example, and importantly for Hegel, the Enlightenment cannot recognize that the self really is the content. So, I mean, what happens here is Pure Insights makes very, very Feuerbachian noises to faith. It says, you think you're talking about God, you're just projecting, you know, an image of a human being onto the world, and onto the absolute, and you know, and all that kind of move. And sure enough, right, that is what faith is doing. But faith in doing that is doing the right thing, since the real content of substance is subject, but because pure insight doesn't recognize that content, it can't recognize itself in the attempt to make that content, and hence is thrown back on its own emptiness, its own negativity. That's paragraph 549. Or again, It can't recognize that the question of faith is an attempt to show that any relationship to another must be made through a mode of self-relationship. So in criticizing faith, it loses its own self-relative and reflective constitution. Or again, fails to see itself and the necessity for self-relation in its relationship to another. Because that's true. You know, you can, I mean, let's remember for Hegel, no relation to another without a self-relation, and no self-relation without a relationship to another. That's the Hegelian form. That's the thought. Absolute self-recognition and otherness,
and that's a faith, and that's a faithful structure.
No, faith has that structure, but again, in the wrong form, because faith says my self-relationship—that's what the mover made faith—puts me in relationship to the other. Right? Now that is a kind of insight. There's a truth to that, right? A structural truth. But because pure insight only sees, as it were, something like passionate yearning, it doesn't realize the kind of insight that the logic of faith enacts.
Whereas what's wrong with faith is that it has a kind of insincere doubling and misspoken.
So, ergo, the point throughout all this criticism is that pure insight does not recognize itself in faith. Doesn't recognize itself in its other. And therefore doesn't recognize that both seek to overcome the self-alienation of culture, and that both fall afoul for the same reason, namely they both seek a pure or immediate relationship to essence. Faith does it positively, pure insight does it negatively. But both assume that the overcoming of the self-alienation of culture requires a pure or immediate relationship to essence. And both are projects of immediacy. And we'll see throughout this whole section, alienation is such a problem of modernity that at every moment you feel that the false forms of consciousness are another form of hippiedom. And that's right. That's absolutely right. What we're looking at is a variety of 17th, 18th century hippies. That's, and I'll say more about that. The Pietists were explicitly hippies of their own time. And I gather that they're alive and well in Santa Cruz. In Tübingen. God bless Tübingen.
They have this great ritual called Schweigen für das Frieden, where everybody stands in front of the church in a circle and is silent for an hour to produce world peace.
Yeah. We did a lot of that in the 60s. Okay.
Sorry, I guess I can't give a very disclosive example.
Well, it is in a way, but it will be this week. Now, in this sense, faith finds the kinds of criticism that pure insight makes beside the point. That is, it knows, faith knows, that it is more than what enlightenment claims for it. And we may say that its confidence is that pure insight makes faith a form of deception that is like a perceptual mistake. You know, you thought you saw X, but you saw Y. To which faith wants to respond that that kind of criticism cannot amount to anything with respect to what is something like a form of life itself or an indeterminately bordered language game. And in a sense, Hegel agrees with faith about that. Hegel is saying that insofar as, and this is Hegelianism, because nothing is completely false, at the spiritual level, a form of life, for Hegel, or a complete language game, including the religious language game, must have a kind of truth in it, and therefore can't be false in the way that Enlightenment critique presupposes it to be false. Right? And that's what I meant why when I said that I was worried by forms of critique, of which Deleuze and Guattari are an example, that make mistakes that make the notion of falsity something like absolute error. Right? Because it's unclear how something that has the weight, strength, and complexity and the historical longevity, say, of religious practice could simply be a mistake. This would be a weird thing to say about human life. Oh yeah, there was religion, but it was a big mistake.
To the extent that there'd be chance, how could they even make that kind of plan though? I mean, the list has this sort of rap about stupid problems, and isn't it more along those lines for him? I mean, I'm not familiar with that particular section, but just given the general tenor of the types of arguments that he makes.
Sure. All I'm saying is that they place the notion of accountability in the wrong place, because they're going to say that because they're going to give a wholly externalist explanation of the power of past forms to sustain themselves, namely in terms of an economics. And I want to say that economic analyses just strike me as for very complicated, long and enduring ranges of human phenomena to be deeply worried in the way I'm worried about this Enlightenment critique of religion. Okay. Or to put it in another way, if you go with them, and this would be true, you lose the notion of history. And of course, that's their project, to return history to nature in a big way, but a nature now conceived very, very differently, that is, in terms of a kind of libidinal pump station. And this, of course, is continuous with Hegel's earliest problem, namely, what's the relationship of any philosophy to its past?